Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 3rd of April, 2020. On the podcast today, Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil and Gas, provides a corporate and operational update. Plus, Brian talks about the measures they've taken in response to COVID-19 and the ongoing oil price volatility. Also on the podcast, Tony Sirichik, CEO of Salt Lake Potash. And Tony discusses the significance of them completing the civil earthworks at their Lake Way project. Also, Neil Crabb, Chief Executive Officer of Frontier IP Group, explains their investment strategy. Plus, I have Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, who looks at the FTSE 100 companies who are cutting, cancelling or delaying their dividends. Don't forget, I also have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies and the top five most liked RNSs too. Oh, and one other thing, don't forget, if you go to voxmarkets.co.uk, on the front page there, you'll see a Vox COVID-19 index. These are companies who are tackling the virus in some way or benefit in some way from the virus. So they're all in that kind of, for example, you have companies like Tristel, you have Open Orphan, Dev Clever. These are companies that won't be affected either by the pandemic because they're online, or they are in some way directly involved with tackling the issue. Check that out there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian Larkin, CEO of United Oil and Gas. UOG is ticker there. Brian, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome, Justin.
It's very interesting times, not just because of COVID-19. I mean, I think you're in the centre almost of a storm, but you seem to be weathering very well, as opposed to some companies, I suppose. But we'll get into some updates in a bit, Brian. But before we do, and the current market, but before we do, as always, if someone's listening right now and has never heard of you or know you vaguely, just give them a brief summary as to what United Oil and Gas is all about, please.
Sure. Well, United Oil and Gas is a full life cycle E&P company from exploration right through to production. We've got an asset base in Egypt, including assets in Egypt, northern Italy. So we've got some licenses in the North Sea, central North Sea, and we've got some exploration in Latin America. The company, we're currently producing just shy of 1,900 barrels of oil equivalent per day. We're headed up by a young but experienced leadership team.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff. Now, like I said, do you know what? COVID-19 came along, coronavirus, an awful pandemic, swept the world, which of course has knocked the economy. On top of that then, as if it wasn't bad enough, you have Saudi and Russia going into a bit of an oil war. And so you being an oil and gas company, of course, right in the epicentre of this. But I saw your update come out yesterday. I was surprised. There's a lot of positivity in there, because all we're getting at the moment is pretty much profit warnings and revenue warnings and all this stuff, and people don't know, can't give any financial guidance. But what's your thoughts at the moment, Brian? Where we are, the current market?
Well, I guess firstly, it's a very difficult period for humankind, and it's hard to put everything into perspective. People are feeling the pain on two fronts. Firstly, the virus itself, and then secondly, in the markets. And a lot of people, including our shareholders, I'm sure, have seen a lot of their personal wealth and net worth wiped out. Mm-hmm. In the oil market, it's been particularly challenging, and we certainly, for the next 6 to 12 months, maybe even longer, we do foresee a low price environment. And as such, we've taken some steps over the last 3 weeks to reshape our business. And I think the key for us when we're looking at the business is not about survival for 3 to 6 months, but it's survival for 12 to 18 months in a low oil price environment. And as we covered in our announcement yesterday to the market, we have a plan that we anticipate will see us through that period. But thankfully, we've got a robust production business. We've got a hedge in place, so hopefully that protects us. But we've made some decisions on deferral of non-essential capital expenditure. We've pushed some of that out into 2021 where we could. We've also taken a look at our cost base and taken out what costs that we could do. Some of that was organic because obviously we're on a travel restriction, etc., and people are not going to the office every day, so there's some organic savings. But overall, we've put a shape in the business which should see us through the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, it is the oil and gas business is you know, it's boom and bust price wise, isn't it? We've seen, you know, these kind of prices a few years back, and then it goes up, and a lot of people get caught out by that. But I suppose, you know, cost of production is all important, isn't it, in times like this?
Well, I've been through this twice. Oil and gas and commodity prices always tend to be cyclical. Sometimes you can manage to predict the downside and sometimes you can manage to predict the upside. But this one probably came as a bit of a shock and out of the blue to everybody. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, United was positioned where we have a small team. We can adapt and adopt our business very quickly. But the oil price will come back. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Yeah. It's cyclical. It always has come back. Demand will return when we get through this COVID-19 crisis, which we will. Mm-hmm. And when we do, people will get back on aeroplanes because they have to. Manufacturing will return because it has to. The current oversupply will be absorbed, and then there will be more demand for oil again. It will return. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I think it will be a longer period, but I'm confident that it will return. And as I've said, I've been through this twice before, so we've always been conscious of the fact that we could have a dip in the oil price cycle. And if you also look at it from a wider macro context, there's been very few large ultra elephant discoveries in the last 5 or 6 years because all the majors have cut a lot of their capex budgets. So there hasn't been that kind of refilling of the hopper of reserves and resources. Mm. So, you know, it's a product that will come back into demand. We haven't had the supply of new large discoveries over the last 3 or 4 years. So certainly do feel that, you know, the demand for product will return. And, you know, it's about getting through this for as many oil and gas companies as possible so that when we all come out the other side, we're well positioned to go again and take advantage on the upside and on the market returning.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'll be some casualties there, won't there? I mean, that's the nature of the business, I suppose. But like I said, if you go through Egypt update, you've got low cost production there. You've got some hedging going on. Take us through the details, if you could, Brian.
Yeah, well, we announced yesterday that we've monetized the gas. We were previously flaring gas, and we've now managed to put in a pipeline, pretty low cost pipeline. We're extremely happy with the cost. The cost is approximately $250,000. That'll pay back pretty quickly. It's increased production by about 150-200 barrels a day net to us, which brings our production in Egypt just up to approximately 1,900 barrels of oil equivalent per day, which is double what we first started looking at when we were looking at acquiring these assets over 12 months ago. So Egypt now has always had positive operational cash flow, even in a low commodity price environment, which is crucially important. In addition to the low operating cash flow, it's really driven by a low operating cost of $6.50 per barrel, which is one of the lowest operating environments probably in the world. In addition to that, we obviously have our hedge in place, which for 6,500 barrels of oil per month at $60 a barrel. So, and that hedge is doing what it should be doing for us. It's covering us on the downside. Mm-hmm. And hedges are a little bit like insurance policies. You know, people can be a little bit apprehensive of them and, you know, where is the value? Well, the value is in times like this when you need it. It's like insurance. It's, you know, when you need it, it's when it's most valuable. Mm-hmm. In addition to the oil hedge, we also have our gas, including the additional gas which we're monetizing now via the new pipeline, and that's sold under a fixed contract that's relatively insensitive to oil and gas prices. So in theory, that's an extension of our oil hedge. So all in all, we have about 30-35% of our production under a hedge, which is excellent. We're also drilling an infill well at the moment, and we hope to update the market on that shortly.
Yeah. So you've got cash flow coming in, and you're also cutting, reducing capex where you can. And what about other parts of the business, Brian? What's happening there?
Well, I guess to talk a little bit about the assets that we've maybe outgrown a little bit probably ahead of schedule too. We've taken a view, which was always our intention, having completed the acquisition of the Egyptian assets, that we would reevaluate our portfolio. And at this point in time, and particularly with the COVID crisis, your eye is a little bit more sharper to where we can realise near-term value and create maximum value in a tough environment for our shareholders. And as we look at our asset base, there's two, I guess, pots of assets that stand out. One is Benin. We've decided not to execute our option in Benin. It's not that we don't like the asset. We absolutely do. We just don't see a near-term value trigger in the short term for us in that license. So at this moment in time, it's right to step away from that. And perhaps down the road, we will return to it. But certainly now, we feel that it's the right opportunity just to step away from that one. Yeah. In addition, we have a cluster of assets in the Wessex Basin, which we always refer to as our Wessex Basin business, and that includes Watercross, PL090, and Coulter, the Coulter Discovery. And I think at this stage, looking at the business and how we can best resource the business and where we see near-term value triggers, we just feel that the Wessex Basin business, we've probably just outgrown it. Again, like Benin, we still do believe that those assets, that pot of assets, do contain some value, but right now we feel we can achieve greater value by developing the existing asset base, fueled by our existing bandwidth.
Yeah, absolutely. And thoughts about, going forward here? I mean, because, it's, some people say it's probably not the right time, but I mean, these kind of situations do throw up, like you say, right now, a healthy company is a company that can adapt and evolve, and that can prosper. And so what are you looking for? Are you looking at other things at the moment, or are you just focusing on your current assets?
Well, I think we have a lot to keep us busy in the existing asset base. I mean, we can talk about Italy and Jamaica too. And, firstly, the tragic events in Italy are extremely challenging. And firstly, our thoughts are with the people in Italy and our colleagues in Italy. They've obviously had, the brunt of the COVID-19 virus. And whilst we want to put Selva into production as quickly as we possibly can, obviously, we have to be sensitive and supportive to our Italian colleagues and the people we deal with in Italy, including the ministry. But we would anticipate a delay in forced production now from Italy. We expect that to slip into certainly some period of half one 2021. At this stage, I couldn't be more specific on actual timings, because obviously, to a large extent, that would be played out by COVID-19. In Jamaica, Tullow Oil, our partner in Jamaica, has obviously written down the value of the license. We have had a dialogue with the Jamaican authorities. We've expressed their interest to move that license forward at 100%. And hopefully those discussions go well, and we will update the market on that in due course also. But getting back to your question, are we looking at other opportunities? Well, crisis does create opportunity, mm-hmm. and there's no doubt about that. And I think it would be silly of us not to be considering potential opportunities, but certainly not in a current equity market position would we consider any potential deals or where the oil price currently is. It wouldn't make sense. But where we do want to position United is when the price cycle begins to move north again, that we are positioned, that should opportunity present itself, that we could move should something come along. But really, I think, as I've really, the main focus for the business will be developing our existing asset base and making sure we're getting maximum value for capital deployed.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as your ambitions are concerned now, I mean, have they changed, or what's the score there?
No, ambition has not changed whatsoever. I keep going back to the oil and gas life cycle, the commodity price life cycle. it will return. And, you know, you as a management team, as an executive team, and as a CEO, we, my team, have to take the longer term view. We will come through this. We will come through this current cycle. And we will look to continue to grow the business. The ambition has not changed. You take advantage when you can. And at times like this, you hit the pause button, you reassess, and you wait for the play button again for when the opportunities reemerge, so that you're positioned to take advantage of them. And that's exactly what we'll do. The ambition has not changed one iota. Mm-hmm. Our plan is still to continue to grow the company, to expand the E&P life cycle outwardly, to improve and grow our asset base, to increase production levels. All in all, we would hope and expect that we should deliver more value for our shareholders, which would be reflected in our share price.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, Brian, well, as always, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, just give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think the first one is that we're a production-based business, so we are significantly de-risked from an equity position or equity perspective. We've got a strong hedge in place, which is doing its job in a low-cost environment, which is exactly why you take a hedge out in the first instance. We've low-cost production as well, which is usually advantageous. I think the second reason is we've done what we said we'd do in terms of building our business. We've acquired assets at the right time, and we're also divesting assets at the right time. And we would hope to see that value reflected in our share price when sentiment returns to the market. And I think finally, we're a young but experienced and extremely ambitious management team. And we are determined to ride out this life cycle to take advantage of it on the upside.
Marvellous stuff. Brian, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Justin. Anytime.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. SO4 is the ticker there. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Good to be back.
Yeah, early morning here. Is it late afternoon in Australia?
We're mid-afternoon on a Friday. It's 3 p.m. here.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, you've announced some news, the completion of civil earthworks for a process plant site. So yeah, you're cracking on there. Before we get into that and the significance of that, could you just explain for people not familiar what SO4 Salt Lake Potash is all about, please?
Sure. We're a Western Australian-based company that's in construction to be producing sulfate of potash, or SOP, for the fertiliser industry. And we have 9 lakes in an extensive portfolio out in the goldfields regions of Western Australia. We are commencing our first project at Lake Way, and that is the one we are going to talk about today, that is well into construction.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning, how many potential projects are there?
Well, we have 9 lakes, or think of it as 9 mine sites in our portfolio. So it's a very, very simple build process on the lake, digging trenches and drilling boreholes and building solar evaporation ponds. And then the off-lake work is a very simple process plant. So once we're very comfortable on our first Lake Way project, we can control C and control V to other projects and potentially walk it up to 3 or 4 operating sites in the next 5 to 6 years.
Yeah. And before we get into what's happening at Lake Way here, just explain, financially, the numbers so far that you could extrapolate from these projects.
In terms of the value, you mean?
Yeah.
Potential? Well, the BFS, I can refer to that because we have a bankable feasibility study that's been completed for Lake Way, showing a net present value of around about $480 million Aussie dollars. And that's a construction project cost there of about $254 million Aussie dollars. And they're all post-tax numbers. Post-tax IRR is 28%, so pretty juicy. And it's representing a really swift 3.5-year payback. So nice financials. And that's only around one lake, not the multiple lake that we will grow into.
Yeah, absolutely. So take us through the earthworks. What have you been doing down there?
Yeah, look, this is just another targeted milestone that we've achieved, as usual, a little bit ahead of schedule. We finished our stage 2 on-lake works there back in February, about a week ahead of time, and now we've just completed our civil bulk earthworks off-lake, that is namely the process plant and non-process infrastructure, foundations work, and we finished that about 2 weeks ahead of schedule, and we're now demobilising equipment and people from site.
Yeah, so essentially this is a good timing because everything's going into lockdown. So now you're going, what, much into sort of office work or phone line or online work, I suppose, are you?
Well, you know, you're absolutely correct in what you're saying. If anything like this that's happening in the world today was to happen, we would want it to be happening right now in our schedule. So we've sort of finished everything to do with what we've called stage two, on lake and off lake. Now it's a very heavy piece of work completing the engineering and design and procurement. We're in that window now, which is just natural project schedule timing. So that's what the heads down, thumbs up are focusing on at the moment. But we have a small contingent continuing up there drilling. We've got some boreholes being drilled in the Paleo Channel. We've obviously got the stage one and stage two on lake operations. It's been in commercial operations now for nearly 12 months. So we've got a team up there continuing to operate. And we have mobilised and have commenced concreting up there. And steel will start arriving on site there in a couple of months' time. So it's quite an interesting period now where there's much more focus off lake. Off-site.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is one milestone. What's the next sort of big milestone you're hoping to tick off there?
Well, ultimately, commencement of plant construction. You know, there's different things you can sort of, depending on what audience you're talking to, it could be, you know, first major concrete pour, first steel erected. The construction of the process plant will start in earnest in about 3 months' time. So we're sort of looking around that middle of the year. And then Q3, Q4 is just a very, very busy time on site, putting all the Lego pieces together. And we are on schedule to commence commissioning December this year.
Yeah. And you're saying hopefully first revenues in Q1 next year?
That is, the project is still on schedule, yes, as we are today. Yeah. And there's no effects with suppliers. It's a very common question at the moment with the issues going around the world. We've checked and double-checked, and we are in weekly contact with all our major suppliers of the kit that's coming to site, and at this point in time, none are affected.
Absolutely, marvellous stuff. Okay, well, Tony, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, as always, give them the three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
No, oh, my three T's, I call them. So the technicals, and under that is, you know, have the simplicity of this this type of project in terms of dealing with brine and sunshine and a very simple process plant. It's a very high-grade quality brine that's going to make a high-grade quality fertilizer that will demand premium pricing. Also sitting in that technical banner is, you know, the very accessible infrastructure that's wrapped around this, or existing infrastructure that's wrapped around Lake Way. We've got an airport existing on the north edge of the lake. We've got gas line existing on the east edge of the lake and a highway on the west edge of the lake. So very, very supported from a technical infrastructure perspective. Second T I refer to as the thematics. You know, it's a growing population. It's a, you know, there's improving wealth in the middle class, and with that comes shifting diets. And this is the premium fertiliser that is required to basically support the growing mouths and shifting diets in the world. And the last one, the last T is the team. It's a fantastic team, thousands and thousands of years of experience in construction and operation that I've amassed here with me, and most I've worked with in past lives before, and we've delivered many projects together. And this is just another notch in the belt.
Yeah, and you've been buying a few shares of late, haven't you?
Incredible value. You know, we've been dragged down by this global tide that floats all boats, or in this case, sinking some. And we've come down with that tide. Nothing's changed. Nothing. The team's the same team. The technicals are the same technicals. The thematics are the same thematics. So we continue to deliver and hit milestones, and our share price is very depressed in this market. So I see enormous value in there, and that's why I've walked back in to buy more, and we'll continue to do so.
Marvellous stuff, Tony. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we're catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin. Wonderful to talk.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Crabb, Chief Executive Officer of Frontier IP Group. That's FIPP ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Now, we've not had you on the podcast before, so for people not familiar with you, and for me as well, just summarise what Frontier IP Group is all about, please.
Sure. So we help universities and IP owners commercialize their intellectual property. Mm-hmm. We do that, importantly, not just by investing, but actually helping them deliver both the scale-up and the industrial traction that is essential for them to be successful. And I guess really key to the investment proposition is that we do that in return for owning a substantial stake in the spin-out company that results from that activity.
I understand. And currently, how many companies have you invested in? How big is your portfolio there?
So we're about 20 companies currently. And interestingly, when you say invest, it is worth flagging that typically we are getting founding equity at no cash cost when we start out. So that makes us very different from the peer group companies.
Yeah. And do you have a sort of specialist sector or area?
So we focus on what we actually call clusters, because really what we worry about is the scale-up challenge, which doesn't lend itself necessarily to the normal investor sectors. But to give you a feel for what they are, mm-hmm. We look at pathogens and cells. Mm-hmm. We look at AI and data and robotics. We're looking at the food and agritech space. And we look at materials science as well. So wow. Those are the core areas where typically we will see common scale-up challenges in those clusters. And by doing them repeatedly and getting to know the industrial partners in that place, we can add more value.
Yeah. And also sort of very much looking towards the future of tech and IP and all that stuff, because that's some very hot sectors there, aren't there?
There are indeed. We're really focused on the areas that are relevant to maybe industry rather than consumer, mm-hmm. and where there is a lot of pressure from big industry to see new innovation, but where they actually struggle to access it from the university partners. So the UK is fantastically good at research. We've got 200,000 scientists. We produce about 15% of the world's top papers with only about 3.5% of the scientists. But we've not been as good as we should be at translating it. And that's really the space that we occupy, to make it fit for purpose for industrial partners.
Got you. Okay. Now, you've recently released some news on one of your sort of investments or portfolio partners there. So what's this? And it's about COVID-19.
Well, in fact, there are actually three companies in the portfolio that have had COVID-19 very recently. So let me just give you a quick run through those. So first of all, yesterday we saw Exscientia, which is a world leader in AI design of drugs. In fact, it's the first AI company in the world to have an AI design drug go into human clinical trials. And they've announced that they are working yesterday with Oxford University and with the Scripps Institute in the US, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to screen some 15,000 chemicals and drugs to test them for their activity against COVID-19. So this is looking for treatments that might help to ameliorate the symptoms of the virus, and therefore obviously impact on improving the outcome for the patients that are suffering from it. So that's one area. Mm-hmm. On Monday, we had another company in the portfolio, Elute, announced that we were releasing free, actually, to any researchers in the field, a specialist COVID-19 search tool that would allow them to search all of the relevant research papers in the area to find out what's already known, essentially. And one of the problems is there are literally thousands of papers that relate to this area. And the problem for a researcher is, how do I find the information that is therefore relevant to what I'm doing? So we've made that available for free, but actually that technology has much wider application in a whole range of industry areas. We've just turned obviously to the immediate COVID challenge because it is pressing and urgent for everybody.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, we have a company called The Vaccine Group, and they very specifically are focused, and as far as we're aware, they're the only player that's really doing this, on looking at animal vaccines to tackle COVID-19. And as I suspect listeners will be aware, we have strong evidence that the vaccine, the virus itself emerged from an animal population. It's thought that it might be bats, but then has passed through intermediary species to infect humans. If we don't seek to remove that reservoir of viral infection, we run the constant risk that either the current version comes back into the human population, or it continues to evolve and a new version comes back and we find ourselves back at ground zero. So the vaccine group doing very important work in looking at that. It's in fact already had, for other vaccines it's working on, money from the UK, US and Chinese governments, so had already been tackling a number of other what we call zoonotic diseases And it turns out that most of the new diseases that emerge in the human population, in fact, aren't completely new, but they've come from mutation to existing diseases that are already present in the animal population.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I was just reading the other day that SARS and MERS are exactly the same. And so you're right. I mean, it's a good vein to go down, I suppose. And what's your goal? What's your aim here at the group? What's the potential? What do you hope to achieve here by investing in these companies? What's the ultimate dream or ambition here?
So the real aim is, as I say, not to go direct to consumers or anything like that, but to take really good and important research and turn it into products and services that are directly useful for industry players that already have large-scale traction with their customer bases, be they individuals or companies. So that's an area where there has been really very poor translation, I would say, on average in the past. It's a well-recognized problem. And our skill set is to say, take that research and say, turn it into useful products. And if you can do that consistently, where you own effectively a piece of the output by being a stakeholder in the spin-out through which that's effected, then we believe we can build very substantial value for our shareholders. And if you look at the last interim results that we reported not so long ago, you can see that the numbers are very definitely moving in the right direction in terms of evidencing that is being achieved.
Yeah. And as far as, the pipeline is concerned, so what are the companies, right now achieving or towards commercialization, at the forefront?
Yeah. So clearly those that are COVID-related that I have just touched on, a lot of the effort of governments is being diverted in that area. And we would therefore expect to see continued news flow from those companies. I think in the rest of the economy, there are a number of other companies in our portfolio that we believe will have what I might call second order opportunities that arises from this. So, for example, we have a company that does real-time logistics. We have another one that is in robotics for crop picking. These are areas where they're not directly addressing the disease, but people have recognized that we need better logistics if we're going to get food to everybody. They've recognized that maybe labor isn't available to pick crops. So I think, they would be longer term beneficiaries. I think across the board, some companies obviously are definitely seeing delays. I mean, you'll be aware of the suspension of a large part of economic activity. Mm-hmm. But we've got companies like Nandi in the portfolio that are delivering novel proteins for a range of foods, including there's a lot of growth and interest around the whole sort of vegetarian and vegan area of food products. We've got another company, Elucid, which is specializing in making recycled tiles. And again, that's at the stage of being scaled up and ready to roll out. So across the board, I would say that the immediate news flow is likely to be weighted towards those that have a COVID angle. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of others that I think people are going to be reviewing what actually our sensitivities are and what the pressing priorities are. And so there will be some in the portfolio that will benefit from essentially strengthening our infrastructure and our delivery of services as a result of the COVID piece. And then we've got another set of companies that essentially are primed and ready to go as the economy comes back on stream, because they have already worked out how they're going to scale up and they are addressing, for example, recycling, energy efficiency, and the food supply chain, which are all major segments which are very open to receiving new innovation.
Yeah, very interesting. And how do you come about, these companies? How do you find them?
So it's a mixture. In some cases, we have formal university relationships. So, for example, we have a number of spin-outs from Plymouth University, where we have had a partnership for a number of years where we work with them. Our main operational base is in Cambridge, and we have a number of spin-outs that effectively happen on an ad hoc basis there. So we've got two, for example, that we've done in conjunction with the Graphene Centre in Cambridge. We have others where we just see projects that fit well with those clusters that I described earlier. And then finally, we have a footprint in Portugal, where we've got four spin-outs now. And that's really a result of outreach from some of the Portuguese institutions, recognizing that one of the strengths in the UK, in fact, is this commercialization process. And that's something that, while they've got very good and differentiated research there, they don't have the infrastructure for its exploitation. So they've reached out to see if we can partner and help deliver that, which we're in the process of doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's quite exciting being involved in these cutting-edge technologies and industries, isn't it? You know, knowing that, you know, one of them could be, even if one of them, you know, works out, it could be huge.
They're all addressing very large markets. You know, if you do something in the food space, for example,
yeah,
obviously people eat a lot of food. Sadly, this COVID thing is clearly a global challenge, but it's pleasing to see that we've got a number of companies that are seeking to help address that. But we start at the outset to make sure that we're picking things that are capable of making a material difference and doing it in a way that makes economic sense. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the focus of the academics. So our first job really is to say, in very simple terms, do we think the economics are compelling? Because if you don't have compelling economics, industry, when you get to it, they'll say they're interested, but they'll then find that it doesn't work to deploy and roll out the solution. On the other hand, if you can plug, you know, a very small startup into a very large industrial player, they're capable of delivering the volume and the reach, which should be very good for our shareholders.
Absolutely, yes. Okay. All right. Now, well, listen, as always, on the podcast, what I do is I highlight the top five most followed companies every day in the podcast. And to get on that list, someone has to hit that follow button on your page quite a few times. So for people listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Right. So the first thing is the business model. The fact that we are getting our equity for free in some of the most exciting research in the UK and then have a direct route to adding value to it, I think is really important. From an investor point of view, we also kind of spread the risk. We are across, as I mentioned at the start, a whole range of companies, and therefore you get the benefit of a portfolio effect. It's very difficult externally to pick winners, but clearly, from our model, we are effectively spreading that risk. So there's a portfolio effect. And then I think if one thinks more short-term about the share price, as I've flagged, we've got a really exciting range of things that are directly addressing some of the fundamental challenges in the COVID space at a time when a large part of the economy is actually on hold. And we would expect to see continued strong news flow from that segment.
Excellent stuff. Neil, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockport AJ Bell. You're up, Russ?
I'm in good health, I'm pleased to say, Justin. Are you and your family too, I hope?
Yeah, all good. Well, I'm pretty
good. Well, that's the most important thing.
I tell you what was happening. I'm probably doing more physical exercise because I do my run in the morning on the treadmill there, and then the boys in the garden, every time I walk past them to the office, said, Dad, play football. So I've got to spare a few minutes. We play football. So
very good.
It's okay. Do you know what? Thankfully, we've got a garden. You know, I couldn't imagine being in a flat with a family of four.
It must be very hard. It must be very hard indeed.
So. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I just tweeted out something now, and I think people are always thinking we're going to recover. You know, as soon as we switch the economy back on, we'll recover. And part of me is thinking, no, if you look at the job figures and all that stuff, and I've sort of likened it to an induced coma. And I said, listen, the longer it stays, the longer it'll take to recover.
And I think that's probably right.
Yeah, it's like a patient, isn't it? If you've got a patient in induced coma for a month, you can't just get out of bed and run around. You know, it's going to take a while to recover, to get back to speed. And the longer we are in that, if it took a couple of months, you know, will it ever fully recover? That's the thing, because there'll be certain issues. I mean, obviously in years to come, it'll do well. But people are thinking it's snap back to where it was.
It's understandable. I mean, it's a lovely idea to think of a V-shaped recovery, but you know, if you've been dead and lucky enough to lose your job, then clearly your ability to go out and celebrate when we're all allowed out is curtailed. And some companies, I fear, probably won't make it to the other side, even allowing for all of the assistance that they're getting. So I think that there will be some damage. And yeah, great. I hope it is a V-shaped recovery, but I wouldn't want to be, you know, betting or speculating on it, I think. And it's one of those psychological things, you know, past and to come seems best, things present worst, to quote a bit of Shakespeare for you. Mm-hmm. That's from Henry IV. And markets obviously like to look forward. They generally err on the optimistic side. And they are, I think, still pricing in a rapid snapback. But the longer it goes on, as you say, I think the trickier things get. And you just look at the way in which the weekly claims for unemployment are piling up in the US. I mean, we actually flagged this a couple of weeks ago, that survey USA poll that showed that, what was it, something like 9 million Americans had told that survey that they'd lost their job.
Yeah.
And you, in the next 2 weeks, what's happened? You've had 9.3 million claim. So that was a pretty accurate survey. So I'm waiting for Survey USA to put the next one up, because that was well ahead of the official Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers. And yeah, hopefully these people will get back to employment quickly, but will it be at the drop of a hat? I'm not so sure, because companies will obviously take time to regather their earnings, but let's hope so. But I think after that initial, you know, that big rally we got last week, again, as we've discussed it, you want to be looking to buy on the bad days, not piling in when things are sort of a monster rally, because I think there could be some more bad news around the corner. And I think markets have gone from being panicking to thinking, actually, we're going to come through this quite quickly. And I suspect the truth is probably somewhere between the two.
Yeah. Finance and Shakespeare there. You can't get a lot better than that, Russ.
There you are, you see. Past and to come seems best. Things present worst.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, we were talking about just beforehand dividends, because I did tweet out a while back, actually. The company, I think it was last week, the amount of companies that cut their dividends, and then it was piling up. But you've been looking at the FTSE 100. How many?
Well, I think across, I've got a little spreadsheet in front of me, and I reckon it's over 200 companies in total, main market and AIM. And in the FTSE 100, BAE Systems is the 25th FTSE 100 firm to now they've deferred, they haven't cancelled. Yeah. Some have deferred, some have cancelled, some have suspended. But whatever way you slice it, that has basically means that for 2019, the bulk of those have been for 2019, some have been for 2020. But looking at what they've announced for 2019, at the end of February, analysts were looking for up 89 to 90 billion pounds worth of dividends from the FTSE 100 for 2019. That figure's gone down to 77 billion. So that gives you some degree of quantum. But yeah, there's about, well, there's still 70. Next have said they're looking. One auto trader have said they're looking, it's part of the contingency plans. But that leaves about 73 companies who've so far broadly kept stum. SSE have said that they're looking to stick to it. I think National Grid have said they're assessing the situation. So maybe 71. And the only ones who seem to have drawn a line in the sand and said, we are going to pay, are BP and Shell. Because they've both put out statements this week talking about how much cash they've got, how much extra debt they've raised, how they're cutting capital investment, they're looking to sell assets, cut costs, sweat working capital. And those are now, after HSBC dropping out or, you know, abandoning its second half, they're the two biggest single payers in the index. You know, they are forecast to pay 17, 18 billion pounds worth of dividends between them in 2020. Now, forecasts for 2020 now on the FTSE 100 are the devil's work. If you assume, and my initial guess was, okay, I mean, the banks have said they're not going to pay anything in 2020, but that means obviously come this time next year, they can still propose dividends for 2020 in their 2021 AGMs. So if you were to assume they don't pay a first half, but they just pay the second half, maybe, you know, because they clearly haven't been happy about not paying dividends. You can get to a figure whereby FTSE 100 dividends are kind of £80 billion in 2020, and that puts the index on a 5.5% yield. Now, if all of those companies who have so far announced that they are not paying a dividend in the second half of last year decide just to blow 2020 off completely, then the payment goes down to about £67 billion and the yield goes down to about 4%. So it's still 4.5%. So that's not too bad. But you do really wonder whether more firms will crack over time, either because their model comes under a bit of pressure or just they just think it's a bad look to be giving lots and lots of cash out at the moment. So it's hard to say, but I would say if I was to guess, let's say we end up at about $75 billion for 2019. I would think if you knock off a third of that and call it $50 billion, you might be in the right sort of territory. In which case, just doing the maths right in front of me now, you're probably looking at a yield of, that's the correct number there, that's the correct cell there. Sorry, it's a very big spreadsheet. So you're probably looking at a yield of potentially 3.5%. Which, you know, doesn't sound as exciting as 5 and change as it did a couple of weeks ago, but then given that the 10-year gilt yield is 0.5%, the return on cash is zero, it's probably more realistic figure, all things being equal.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, the only reason why they're doing this, and I suppose you get some companies looking at other companies, because I've seen quite a few companies recently obviously raising money. There's been, I think, there's Hayes, there's Auto Trader.
Auto Trader, Carnival. Yeah.
And you see these companies, well, hang on, and they're cutting their dividend, basically battening down the hatches, you know. Think, other companies not yet announced they're cutting their dividend must think, hang on a second, what do they know we don't know? How dangerous is it, how bad is this going to get? Because no one really knows as yet. So isn't it better to be air on the side of caution rather than not, maybe? I don't know.
I would think politically, I think it's a good look. Mm. And certainly if you're having to furlough staff, I think it's a good look. And I think and we're seeing the other trend that we're seeing is increasing number of management teams announced pay cuts. ITV have actually done that this morning and cancelled all cash bonuses and things. So I think, again, that sense of we're all in this together, I think, is important. Yeah. And yet, there are companies like, you know, Nichols, one of the companies we used to talk about a lot on when we were looking at small caps together. It's got nearly 40 million quid of net cash on its balance sheet, and they've cancelled the second half dividend anyway, because that's saving them 10 million quid, because they just don't know how much Vimto they're going to sell in the next few months. So I don't think management teams are going to be penalised for prudence. I think, if anything, management teams might be penalised by investors for straining to pay a dividend that could be doing damage to the business in the long run if they have to borrow, for example, to fund it. So I think that's probably what investors are looking at more now. So if you are looking for companies that, and clearly income is going to be a huge issue for a lot of investors. So I would think that there may be some companies that, even when you've done your analysis, look safe, may just decide to err on the side of caution, politically, socially, or economically. But if you are looking for those that are going to be safer than most, or could perhaps rebound more quickly than most, clearly a healthy balance sheet is starting point number one. So if you've got a net cash balance sheet or very little debt, that's a good start. If there is debt in the balance sheet, then you need to look at when it's due to be repaid. You know, if you've got companies like Grafton that don't have any debt that's due till 2023, then that gives them a considerable amount of breathing space. And then you can check the covenant. Are there any short-term covenants by which they need to abide? Quite a few companies recently have managed to get covenant waivers. So again, the bank isn't going to run a test and go, okay, we're going to pull the rug now, bye. So I think that is the next. So those are the next three things that you check. And then after that, you check, is it a steady or a cyclical business? Is it relatively insensitive to the economy, like a utility, or is it relatively sensitive, like an industrial? And then if it's a cyclical business, you probably need to look at a 5 or 10 year average earnings per share figure just to see what dividend cover that gives you. And that will give you a degree of comfort as to whether you think, you know, could it be kept? And even if the management team, as you said, just decide to be prudent, how quickly it can bounce back. Because I'm sure there will be management teams, you know, management teams that are aware of shareholders and their needs and how important income is. Equally, their first priority will be to get the company through the other side. And mm-hmm. I think that's the point where we are now. So I think those companies that do hang on, fine. But I think investors will be looking for proof that they're not having to really break their necks to do it and put the company under financial duress to achieve a short-term goal.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, as I said, different sectors, you know, I mean, there are certain companies that won't be affected by this so much because they get paid on a monthly basis, you know, but like I said, telecommunications companies, for example, I mean, everyone's on the internet, broadband, and it's almost like a lifeline.
Sticky customers, very, very important. Yeah, that will be very, very helpful. So, yeah, absolutely.
And even the companies have been taken down by the overall market sell-off, you know, some of them are not as badly affected as others, are they, you know?
No, not at all. I mean, again, you can never say never. I mean, Telecom Plus is one company. It's got very limited amounts of debt. It provides electricity and broadband and things to people. But you know, who's to say that, you know, some of their customers don't get into trouble and have difficulty paying? So, you know, there may still be some issues there. But overall, I think you're probably safer off supplying that than you are being a car dealership, for example. Or obviously, in a worst-case scenario, a pub chain or a cinema chain that's been obliged to close its doors. So you're in a better situation than them. And in most cases, you've got a better balance sheet. So Telecom Plus, you would think, will be one that comes out the other side. You do fear for, you know, certainly some individual publicans and restaurateurs. And we'll see what happens to some of the bigger chains. But, you know, again, as you said, the longer this goes on, the trickier it gets, even allowing for the support that's being provided in terms of rates, VAT, staff furloughs and so on. Some businesses, it might just unfortunately prove to be too much for them. I think the interesting thing, obviously, the role for the banks here is important. I mean, the Financial Times has run that story today that four of the big five banks were not happy about being asked by the Prudential Regulatory Authority to pass their second half dividends. I guess the issue is, will they actually lend out that £7.5 billion? And my suspicion is no. I suspect that they'll use that to buffer their balance sheets in case there are loans that go sour on them, or at least that they don't pull the rug on those loans. So that gives the borrower more time, which I think is what the government is hoping. Again, it's interesting that the Financial Conduct Authority is now talking about credit card payment holidays. Mortgage payment holidays are being discussed in Singapore. Business loan interest holidays are being discussed in Singapore. And I wouldn't be shocked if this lockdown goes on longer, whether wider discussion of interest payment holidays, deferrals or forbearance even comes through. I think we may have discussed this before. You know, the big five banks last year, they've just passed $7.5 billion of dividends. If they don't pay one at all this year, that's another $15 billion. So that's £22.5 billion. The quarterly corporate and UK household interest bill is £28 billion. So if you want to give people breathing space, what's everybody frightened of? They're frightened of not being able to pay their bills. And the most frightening one is not being able to pay your mortgage bill and your interest and your credit card. So if you're just told, ladies and gentlemen, you got 3 months off from worrying about that, I think that would provide a colossal amount of peace of mind to be. It might not solve every problem, but wiping out £22 billion of bank dividends means that they've got that cash to absorb that hit to a degree. And then politically, it's a dead easy sell for Mr. Johnson or Mr. Sunak to say, well, look, you were bailed out in 2009. You're stepping up to the plate in 2020. So I do wonder whether that discussion will continue to gather momentum, with the dividends this week being the first step in the banks being called in to play their role. Because, you know, you listen to Radio 4 this morning, there's lots of discontent from small businesses about how the coronavirus business loans are being handled for small and medium enterprises. And I think that the Chancellor's intervening today to try and get that credit flowing more quickly than it is at the moment.
And like I said, even though we've seen these massive sort of layoffs in America, these jobless claims, I can't see all of those being out of work when the economy kicks back in. Of course, maybe not all will go back to work, but so that's even though it's a massive figure, I think a lot of those will go back to work, Eden. And like I said, there are companies from an investing point of view, they'll become stronger because of this. Of course, the weaker ones will,
because the weaker ones fail and the stronger ones survive.
And this market share will get bigger for this. So just looking for those good companies, look at the figures and seeing which companies are doing well by the figures, and say, well, that's the company I'd prefer to invest in rather than a weak company with a rubbish balance sheet,
The big wild card from a market point of view, and I've just had a look at the number this morning, is the quantitative easing programs that we're seeing from the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and others. I mean, the US Federal Reserve's balance sheet since the 11th of March has gone from $4.3 to $5.8 trillion. So they've added $1.5 trillion of liquidity in 3 weeks, which is more than they did, pretty much in any of the previous, the individual QE1, QE2, QE3 programs. And they were kind of year-long programs, and they've done this in 3 weeks. Now, whether that liquidity brings immediate benefit to the economy, we'll see. I mean, the stock market doesn't feel completely convinced by it, because QE is designed to lower interest rate, bond yields, make credit more available, and encourage people to go out and spend. Well, they can't go out. I know they can do some online stuff, but they can't go out and spend in the traditional sense. But at some stage, when this crisis is passed, as we, let's think positive, that liquidity is going to be looking for a home. And in a world where interest rates are zero and bond yields are basically zero, I mean, there's got to be a fair chance they're going to look for some assets in which to go for a return, and you would imagine that equities would be one of them. Now, I can't see the Fed having the bottle to withdraw that stimulus very quickly, because he didn't do it with any of the previous three rounds. So you can construct a scenario whereby we get the fourth fairly major asset bubble of my financial career, kind of 1998, 2000, 2005, 7, 2017, 19, and then so that liquidity will, I think, at some stage do some amazing things potentially for asset valuations. But it did take the thick end of the year to do it after the financial crisis, so it's probably something that's not going to happen overnight, which is like, you and I, again, yes, by all means, nibble in on the bad days for markets, but don't go all in yet, because as you say, that it's very difficult for us to estimate the degree of the downturn in earnings and dividends that it does now seem to be coming our way.
Yeah, exactly. It's just trying to understand how exactly the depth of this. But like I said, I think, you know, as always, you know, at the back end of a downturn, there's always some great opportunity. It's a chance to get some decent returns over the next 5-10 years, you know. So
correct.
Yeah, excellent stuff. What's the any plans for the weekend?
Now that's cheeky. I think we'll go for our daily walk, and we're going to do some baking with the kids. We're going to make chocolate brownies, and they made millionaire shortbread last weekend. It's simnel cake and chocolate brownies this weekend. Play some board games, watch a movie. We might actually get a take. We haven't done any takeout yet, so we might get a takeout tomorrow night and be a little bit lazy on the cooking front. But hunker down and behave ourselves. You know, if there is any good news, I can pass on. A good friend of ours on this street, talking over about two gardens to them. Her sister is a nurse at Brighton General Hospital, and the wards that they've set aside for COVID-19 patients are now very quiet.
Okay.
Yeah. And Brighton was an early hotspot, and at the moment they actually have more beds than they have patients by quite a distance.
Yeah.
So hopefully the distancing policy is beginning to, at least in this little enclave, which was an early hotspot, bring some positive signs. So fingers crossed we start to see a little bit of that beyond the narrow confines of Sussex.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm just looking at the chart, every day a bar chart of Italy, because I think that's obviously the worst case in Europe. Spain is.
To flatten off, I'm believe.
Yeah, exactly. March the 27th, they had 919 deaths, and since then it hasn't been as high as that. It's slowly, it's not coming down in a straight line, but like yesterday, 760, still a lot, but it seems to have hit a peak there, you know, so it seems to be coming down the other side, so it's a good thing, you know. So,
fingers crossed.
Yeah. Marvellous. Have a nice weekend.
Well, have a good weekend. Enjoy your football.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Centrica. Wow. You can see people going for bigger companies right now because paying dividends may be more stable, and they've come down so much, the return you can get is almost like that of small microcaps. At four, EasyJet. Down 1%. Where's Centrica, by the way? Down 6% to 31.78. EasyJet, it's down 1% to 4.92. At 3, Bidstack down 6% to 7.75 pence. At 2, the AA Group, it's basically non-mover, 15.72 pence. And number 1, most followed companies, Tiziana Life Sciences, TILS ticker there. It's up 7.7% to 36 pence. Okay, time for the top 5 most liked RNSs. At 5, Salt Lake Potash, Lakeway Earthworks completion and COVID-19 update. Of course, I chatted to Tony in the podcast. At 4, Rockfire Resources, operational update. At 3, Optibiotics Health, Slim Bione contract manufacturing agreement. At 2, again, Rockfire Resources, geochemical study strengthens Mount Wright analogy. And at 1, it is Tolu Energy, TLOU, interim power purchase agreement. That sees them up 43% to 2.15 pence. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.